is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, it seems like we are seeing daily changes to the narrative surrounding the Affordable Care Act, starting with the White House. The president announced several important changes to the health law last week, including cutting off the cost-sharing reduction subsidies created by the ACA, which allows insurance companies to offer more affordable premiums to lower-income Americans purchasing health insurance on the exchanges, funds that are specifically earmarked to keep premiums and costs down for consumers. The announcement sent the insurance industry into crisis mode.
Well, Mark, the president called the cost-sharing reduction payments bailouts for the insurance industry, but the reality is those payments go directly to securing affordable coverage for low-income consumers. And without these CSR payments, as they're called, there would be a huge disruption in the insurance market. The Congressional Budget Office reporting that as many as 1 million Americans would not be able to afford their coverage if the subsidies are eliminated. And all of this with open enrollment, a very short open enrollment, starting just a few days away on November 1st.
You know, wait long enough and things will change. But actually, we didn't have to wait long enough. This was a week later, and there's a new wrinkle in the discussion. A bipartisan plan was announced in the Senate to continue funding the cost-sharing reduction subsidies for 2 years. Republican Lamar Alexander and Democratic Senator Patty Murray announced they were close to a final agreement on the bill. At first, the president backpedaled from his stance last week, saying he could get behind this short-term solution to propping up the insurance markets. One day later, though, he's back saying he'll not support the measure.
The president saying in a tweet that, quote, while he supports Senator Lamar Alexander as a person, he cannot, quote, support bailing out insurance companies who've made a fortune, we should put that in quotes too, with Obamacare. In the meantime, there are already a number of legal challenges being mounted against the White House over these CSR payments, as well as the other changes the president has made to the Affordable Care Act through his executive orders, Mark. And we're still waiting for reauthorization of the Children's Health Insurance Plan, or CHIP, which puts health coverage for 9 million American children into question. So with all this uncertainty, one thing that is certain is that those most likely to be impacted negatively are the most vulnerable populations.
Healthcare for the most vulnerable populations is something that our guest today is a champion of. Dr. Mitchell Katz is the director of health for the city of Los Angeles. He's made some sweeping changes to the system that have greatly improved access to care. His innovations in population health have earned him many accolades. I'm really looking forward to this conversation, Margaret.
Well, he is a real innovator, and he's been tapped to run the New York City health system, the largest in the nation. So we are really looking forward to hearing from Dr. Katz.
Laurie Robertson will check in with us. The managing editor of FactCheck.org looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have questions or comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we'd love to hear from you. Now we'll get to our interview with Dr. Mitchell Katz in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Confusion and compromise in Washington concerning the cost-sharing reduction payments to offset insurance costs for low-income Americans, days after the president announced in a late-night memo that he was canceling the cost-sharing reduction payments created under the Affordable Care Act that pays funds to insurance companies so they can significantly lower the deductibles and out-of-pocket costs for lower- and middle-income people purchasing insurance. A bipartisan agreement has been reached in the Senate that would help stabilize those payments for 2 years. Republican Senator Lamar Alexander and Democratic Senator Patty Murray announcing the stabilization agreement. The president's executive order ending the cost reduction subsidies is sending insurance markets, health consumers, and state insurance regulators into uncertain and uncharted waters, just as the next round of open enrollment gets underway in a few weeks. Attorneys general in several states were already lining up with lawsuits against the administration's efforts to eliminate the CSR payments. Meanwhile, the president's executive order to expand the creation of health insurance buying associations, allowing for small businesses to form partnerships to tap into insurance pools and relaxing rules governing the purchasing of insurance across state lines, has been met with a fair degree of skepticism. president claims this will offer an opportunity to buy cheaper options, but it's been tried before and has failed. A number of federal watchdog agencies looked at these so-called association plans. Often, they failed on many occasions to pay legitimate claims for those who used them. The rules governing the management of these association insurance plans are still being worked out. The president's pick for drug czar has removed himself from consideration. Republican Pennsylvania Congressman Tom Marino took himself out of consideration after an in-depth report in the Washington Post in 60 Minutes linked Marino's influence in the passage of a bill in 2016. The Ensuring Patient Access and Drug Enforcement Act made it harder for the DEA to intercept shipments of deadly opioids that were considered suspicious. A former DEA official called that standard set by that law an impossible one to enforce. Opioid overdoses are now the leading cause of accidental death in America. As the death toll rises in the wake of the Northern California fires, another concern is mounting. Air quality in the San Francisco Bay Area and surrounds has been rated at its lowest level on record. The smoke cloud is covering much of the region, and as so many homes, businesses, and vehicles burned in these blazes, that smoke is filled with numerous toxins. It's being compared with the poorest level of air quality in China's most polluted cities. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Mitchell Katz, director of the Los Angeles County Health Agency, the second largest in the country, overseeing the region's four main hospitals, a network of clinics, an $8 billion budget. Before that, Dr. Katz served as director of health for the San Francisco Department of Public Health, where he implemented the Healthy San Francisco program, the first municipal universal healthcare system in the United States, and ran the city's AIDS program as well. Dr. Katz earned his BA at Yale University, his medical degree at Harvard Medical School, and did his residency at UC San Francisco. He'll be leaving Los Angeles at the end of the year to take over the New York City health and hospital system, the largest in the country. Dr. Katz, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Mitch, you've recently announced that your plans to leave the LA County Health Department at the end of the year. You've been nominated to run the largest municipal health system in the country, network of 11 hospitals, 70 clinics, a pretty sizable looming deficit as well. But before we get there, you decided to realign various departments in LA to create a more seamless process for continuum of care. And I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners how you approached the healthcare system challenges when you arrived in Los Angeles and how you brought about the transformation in the healthcare system there.
When I came to Los Angeles, what I saw was that the patients were not being put first. I think to make any system work, the people you're serving have to be at the center of the system. I think any system that doesn't put primary care as the linchpin for improving care is going to fail. So the system that I came to in Los Angeles, nobody had their own physician or nurse practitioner as their provider. Patients came, they saw who they saw. If Dr. A was the doctor on Tuesday, they saw Dr. A. If they needed to come back 2 weeks later, and now it was nurse practitioner B, they saw nurse practitioner B. There was no continuity of care. I think so much is lost if people don't have strong relationships over time with their providers, because we know that how we handle somebody who, say, comes with a headache depends tremendously on what we know about that patient.
Right.
If it's somebody who never complains and is, you know, cheerful and happy and they never have a pain and all of a sudden they tell you they have a terrible headache, it has a different meaning than someone for whom you've cared for years, and having a headache is just one of a long list of issues for them. So putting primary care clinics first, requiring that patients be impaneled to a specific doctor or nurse practitioner, which was quite controversial at the time, I think really was the single intervention that made the biggest difference.
Well, I know that you brought your training and education and your practice as a primary care physician and internist to that work. But you also learned so many valuable public health lessons in your early 90s, working as an internist in San Francisco in a city that was a ground zero for the AIDS epidemic. You were out there trying to launch one of the country's first needle exchange programs at a time when I don't think it was even legal to do that as a public health intervention against the spread of HIV. What did you learn from your efforts in that early needle exchange initiative that ultimately helped to reduce the rate of HIV infection?
Well, I think there are really two lessons, one philosophical and one practical. I think the philosophical one is that while I love being a doctor and I love taking care of people, we have to recognize that medical care, or what people often refer to as sick care, can't really make a huge difference in most people's health. If you want to make a big difference, you have to go upstream, and you have to address the things that are affecting their health. And in the case of needle exchange, it was recognizing that I'm an AIDS doctor, I know all of the treatments for all of the opportunistic infections that kill people, but if I really want to make a difference, I need to prevent infections. So the needle exchange was a way of keeping people from being infected, keeping their partners, their children from getting infected. One of the things that makes me happiest is how much hepatitis C we prevented.
Right.
We didn't even know it. It wasn't labeled. The practical lesson I learned is that if something is right, then you have to pursue it, even if people tell you that it's against the law. Mm-hmm. Right? When we did needle exchange, people said that it would be against the law to fund needle exchange. And what we did is by declaring an emergency, we found a way to do it without winding up in jail ourselves. What matters is something right? Mm-hmm. If it's right, then we have to pursue until we find a method of doing it.
Certainly you bring this sort of practical, very straightforward, figure out what the barriers are, solve them in a program, and then evaluate how well you've done. And I think for all of us who are in the healthcare delivery system, that's often easier said than done. And you've adopted a pretty innovative approach to the problem of homelessness and its impact on healthcare. And I wonder if you could tell us about the program you developed to combat chronic homelessness in Los Angeles. Talk to us a little bit about how you shifted resources to address the issue and how that might be scaled nationally as well.
What I saw working in San Francisco in a public hospital was we would admit patients who were homeless, often addicted to substances. They would come in dehydrated or with mental impairments, and people would spend 2 or 3 days running all of these tests. And when it turned out that the person was addicted to drugs, they would then just discharge them to the street. And I would look and say, you know, we just spent $40,000 on this person. We could have housed them for the rest of their life on what we spent in these 3 days. Mm-hmm. And so we started the idea that we would take the sickest people, the people who were suffering from mental illness, who couldn't manage their diabetes, and we would house them. And over 10 years in San Francisco, housed over 1,000 people, and here in Los Angeles, since 2012, we've housed 3,500 people, all of whom have serious illness. And the big paradigm difference was we said, we'll use health dollars. I think we were the first to say, it's a good investment on health dollars, and it returns us back to the issue of social determinants. What sense does it make for me to try to give medications to a homeless person if they don't even have a place that they can take it?
Well, I think one of your many accomplishments that we've read about in Los Angeles has been to integrate the departments of health and public health and mental health in a single unit. And, you know, it seems kind of obvious to us that if you integrate at the level of the leadership, then you ultimately have a good chance of integrating the care and the services, particularly of primary care and behavioral health, at the level of the patient, something that we obviously have been very committed to in the community health center movement. We'd be really interested in hearing how you've made that work in a health system as large as the one in Los Angeles, some outcomes that you point to as evidence of success we look at that ability to really have the whole system represented, the hospitals and the intensive outpatient, as well as the integrated primary model, as just a shining example. But tell us what you've seen in terms of outcomes.
Well, Margaret, to those of us in the field, it makes total sense. You know, the patients come fully integrated. They may present with bad stomach pain as their expression of their mental illness or of their addiction. They themselves don't come and say, I have a mental health problem, I have a physical health problem. They come and they say that I have a stomach problem. Is it ulcers from drinking too much alcohol? For the people we care for, they're fully integrated. The problem is that the clinicians have all trained in a particular field. There's physical health doctors, mental health clinicians, addiction specialists, and everyone wants to practice in their field, forgetting that it's absolutely impossible for patients to have multiple different paradigms when they're just one person. I think we can say that people are getting better care because we have improved access. And so more people now who come to one of our physical health sites with a mental health problem are getting mental health treatment. The seriously mentally ill live 20 years less than people without serious mental illness. And they're not dying of suicide. They're dying because of sedentary lifestyle, of smoking, of heart disease, issues that primary care providers know well how to care for.
We're speaking today with Dr. Mitchell Katz, director of the Los Angeles County Health Agency. Before that, Dr. Katz ran the San Francisco Department of Health. At the end of the year, he'll be taking over the New York City Department of Health and Hospitals. Dr. Katz, you're a Brooklyn native heading back to your home turf and after decades on the West Coast. So a very political question. San Francisco, Los Angeles, New York, what sports teams are you rooting for? will you declare now?
You know, that's too controversial.
I couldn't
possibly reveal that.
But you are facing very difficult times, the looming deficit. So where do you anticipate your biggest challenges going to be, in the fiscal area, or is it really about establishing the culture?
Well, I think the mayor and the prior director have already, you know, set out the right plan to move to a much more outpatient primary care system. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of why they chose me. It's all in the operations, helping people who have always worked in a hospital setting to find out the joys of being a nurse case manager in the outpatient setting. Mm-hmm. We did that a lot in Los Angeles when I came. And it turns out that many of the nurses who were once working in the hospital, you know, have really enjoyed, you know, their new practice as nurse case managers and have seen what a huge difference it can make. So what I'm hoping to do is to be adept at operationalizing that vision.
Well, Mitch, as you return to the East Coast, you have a, you know, a universe or a domain of New York, but we all live in this larger context of what's going on with healthcare nationally and with health policy changes. Still, so many ways the law could be undermined in terms of access to health services for millions of vulnerable Americans. And, you know, we, of course, are ever mindful that it doesn't address the needs of undocumented persons in this country that have no access. What are your greater concerns as we look towards all this uncertainty in America for people who've gained coverage under Medicaid, under the exchanges, as well as the millions who still aren't covered? And what are you hoping to see this next wave of health reform play out?
Well, the idea of taking away coverage when we really should be extending coverage to people who still lack it in our country is awful. What I would love to see and what we haven't seen is people trying to address how do we improve the current system. We can see ways that it could be improved, but what I'd really like to see us do is move to a place where we're addressing how do we fully extend coverage and how do we improve care. There's a reason that the U.S. ranks at the very bottom of the health measures for countries. And we should be actively addressing that and Sadly, instead, we're trying to hold on to the gains we've gotten.
You know, I just want to say as an aside, you, with the resources of the Affordable Care Act, you really revolutionized the public health system in Los Angeles. So, and also an exemplar for what those types of investments can lead to. And, you know, the health industry is going through lots of transformation, in part by the scientific advances in the areas like genomics and certainly Dr. Collins' All of Us initiative. There's a blooming data analytics and health data sharing environment out there. And I'm wondering how important getting a hold of that information sharing is going to be part of the platform as you think about rebuilding or improving upon the system that you're about to inherit.
I think information sharing is a key part. I think that at every level we need good information when we're seeing somebody. Patients need better information themselves in order to make good decisions, to be more active as consumers of healthcare. My only reservation is that I really believe at its core, healthcare is about healing people. And doctors heal people, and nurses heal people, and pharmacists heal people. Computers, I'm not sure, heal people.
They give them headaches.
Well, Mitch, I know that you've been very focused on transforming the way primary care is organized and delivered in the L.A. County Health System, taking full advantage of an integrated system where everybody's incentives hopefully align in the same direction. You must have, in that L.A. County system, been making a huge contribution to training the next generation of healthcare providers and workers across the board. And I'm curious how you approach training the next generation to this new model of care.
Sure. Well, first, the question needs to be, what is it we're trying to teach them? One of the most disheartening things I heard when I first came to Los Angeles was that the residents couldn't have a panel of patients because, after all, they were residents. They were rotating. And I'm like, well, how could you possibly learn to be
a primary care provider
if you don't have a panel of patients? So we were able to impanel them. Second, when I talked to medical students, I asked them, what do you think from your mentors really smart medical students become? And the answer is always specialist. And I remember that too. I remember that the idea is that if you're really smart, you become a specialist. And of course, my view is that the thing we most need is really smart primary care providers, whether they be doctors or nurse practitioners, physician assistants. We need the best people to go into primary care because it's the most important, and frankly, it's hard to know whether or not when somebody comes in with chest pain, you know, are they having a heart attack or do they have a broken heart? So, you know, I think that demonstrating the joy of primary care, of developing long-term relationships, of taking responsibility for people is the best way to have a new generation with a similar philosophy.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Mitchell Katz, director of the Los Angeles County Health Agency. He will be leading the New York Department of Health and Hospitals in the new year. You can learn more about Dr. Katz's work by going to healthagency.lacounty.gov/leadership. Dr. Katz, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you both.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Donald Trump issued an executive order in October related to the Affordable Care Act. The order instructed the Departments of Labor, Health and Human Services, and Treasury to consider proposing regulations on association health plans, short-term insurance, and employer health reimbursement arrangements. The order said that those items were alternatives to insurance under the Affordable Care Act that's subject to mandates. The ACA requires insurance on the individual or small group market to cover certain benefits and limit out-of-pocket costs, and the law limits how insurers can vary pricing based on individual factors like age. Trump's order also mentioned selling insurance across state lines. It said that the executive branch's policy was to, quote, facilitate the purchase of insurance across state lines. We looked at the issue of selling policies across state lines before and what impact it might have on premiums on the individual market, where those without employer plans or government plans like Medicaid buy their own coverage. If insurance companies could sell across state lines and state regulators didn't have to follow ACA requirements, would premiums drop significantly? Joseph Antos, a healthcare expert with the American Enterprise Institute, told us that while there could be some reduction, insurers would still be locked into the cost of health services in a given geographic area. So a cheap plan in an inexpensive locale would still have to be priced higher if sold in a high-cost area. Linda Bloomberg with the Urban Institute said that some people could see a big drop in premiums if insurers significantly curtailed benefits, selling plans without much insurance protection to healthy people. But that would also drive up premiums for those wanting comprehensive insurance and in states that want to have insurance regulations. It's also unclear how much insurers want to sell plans across state lines. Aetna's CEO said earlier this year that the idea is outdated because insurers now are aligned with networks of providers that they create in a certain area. The American Academy of Actuaries said this year that cost savings from negotiating provider networks can be larger than savings gleaned from differences in benefit requirements. But it may be difficult for insurers entering a new state market to negotiate with providers. It remains to be seen what the agency secretaries will propose based on Trump's executive order. And that's my Fact Check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Pregnancy is normally an exciting time for most women, but according to the research, an estimated 10% of prenatal women experience some kind of depression during their pregnancy, and many are reluctant to treat their depression with medication for fear of harming the fetus.
In fact, a higher percentage are experiencing lower grade depressive symptoms, so they might not meet full criteria for a major depressive episode, but they're having significant symptoms that are getting in the way of feeling good, and left untreated, those mild to moderate symptoms can progress, in some cases lead to a more serious postpartum depression.
Dr. Cynthia Battle is a psychologist at Brown University with a practice at Women's and Infants Hospital in Providence. She and her colleagues decided to test a cohort of pregnant women to see if a targeted prenatal yoga class, which combines exercise with mindfulness techniques, might have a positive impact on women dealing with prenatal depression.
And it was a typical kind of hatha yoga that would include physical postures, breathing exercises, meditation exercises. And we enrolled 34 women who were pregnant who had clinical levels of depression. They all had medical clearance from their prenatal care providers, and they would come to classes, and we measured their change in depressive symptoms over that period of time.
Not only were women able to manage their depressive incidents, they also bonded with other pregnant women during the program and found additional support from their group.
And the initial signs from this research are really encouraging. So we found that women, on average, were reporting much less.
A larger study with control groups is being planned with the assistance of the National Institute of Mental Health.
Women who are depressed during pregnancy, unfortunately, do often have less ideal birth outcomes. So one thing we're interested in seeing if when we provide prenatal yoga program, can it improve mood? And then can we even see some positive effects in terms of the birth outcomes?
A guided, non-medical yoga exercise program designed to assist pregnant women through depression symptoms, helping them successfully navigate those symptoms without medication, ensuring a safer pregnancy and a healthier outcome for mother and baby. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.